Hello and welcome to the Tortoise Shack. Today we're doing another crossover between the Echo Chamber podcast and Reboot Republic. We're celebrating 1 year of Reboot Republic podcasts, and with us we have the host of Reboot, Rory Hearn. Rory, going to jump straight in and say, please tell us, what is Reboot all about?
Well, I was just thinking that maybe we could rename ourselves as the Reboot Chamber and the Echo Republic. How's that? Reboot Republic. So what is it all about? It's about trying to bring the ideas that are out there. There's huge, like, we talk so much about the crisis, you know, the inequality within this country and globally, the crisis of the planet, of sustainability, you know, of creating a society which is more equal and fair. And then we look around us and go, do you know what? There's actually lots of countries who are actually doing it quite well. You know, particularly we point to, you know, consistently countries, the Nordics. And so the question is, how do we do it here? And what do we bring it about? And there's lots of people doing it. There's lots of people with great ideas. The mainstream media, it's very little time you actually hear any sense of in-depth discussion around things. And it's always pitting one person against another. Whereas what Reboot is about, giving a bit of time to get into a bit of depth, have the discussion. It's as dry as possible, as little humour as possible. We really like, as I said initially, it was to be the to put people asleep.
Yeah, well, it does suit you to be humorless. Yeah. I have to say, it really does suit you to be humorless.
Because my absolute lack of it, and I'm proud, and I have not a funny bone in my body, because I just don't have the capacity to think in that way, because I'm so busy thinking about...
I would say when Rory was started that we were kind of thinking initially that he'd do 10 of these and pick 10 topics. How many have you done now, Rory?
I don't know, Tony. Is it over 60, 70?
Oh, you're over 70 now, I think.
I was actually just thinking back there, going through like some of the episode. Like, I remember Mick Burns' first one, where he talks about cost rental. We started that from the outset. We obviously had Leilana Farah from terms of the UN rapporteur. We've had Mary Murphy, June Tinsley, who was with Bernardo's, Hugh Brennan from the co-ops. We've had Seamus Coffey in here from IFAC. We've had Mary Lou McDonald.
You know, Jared Howland.
Jared Howland. Now, Jared was got in under the radar. I thought he was someone else.
Yeah. Go on. No.
Back the City. The Reboot Live was a great event. And, you know, I've had a lot of positive feedback from people saying, you know, there is something in it, that people are finding out things. They're engaged with it. It's raising issues. And so it clearly has hit an audience. The question is, how sustainable is it? Tony, I'm jumping too quick into that.
You're getting me. You're coming to me now, and I don't want to get into it. Is it sustainable? Like, none of these things really seem to be sustainable, because we talk about the media models. We talk to people. We interview journalists, and journalists will tell you that, you know, the things gone behind paywalls or the options of this, and we put this out for free. We put our time into it. We put a lot of what I would call opportunity cost as well, that people don't see, plus the amount of effort that goes into bloody editing, putting them together, sourcing guests, accommodating them, making sure we can work around people's schedules, moving those things. And I know we all have our own stuff going on, but a lot goes into that. And I can tell you, like, it's... There's not a cent in it, like, not a cent. And that is kind of where, that you do have to think from, you know, the long-term viability. If it wasn't for the fact that you meet so many great people, you'd have thrown the towel in months ago. That's
absolutely. It doesn't butter bread for the Waynes.
No, it doesn't. It doesn't. But then we are, like, I've been thinking about this a while. We're kind of public service broadcasting.
Like 30 seconds, is it?
Oh God. Look at the intellectual having a go at me. But we are kind of like public service broadcasting, and we are kind of what we're doing. I mean, I very much see that the people we talk to are the voices that you wouldn't get generally on the media, yet they have...
Why do you put on that voice?
What voice?
Like, when I'm talking to you outside, you're like, kind of like two or three octaves higher, and now you're going into...
Hi.
I'm doing your podcast. I'm going to speak really low. I'm even going to try and speak a bit kind of like...
He's got voice envy. You know what I mean? That's all that is. Now, Rory, please.
Sorry, you were midstream reading out what you'd prepared earlier.
Thanks. Thank you very much. And now I've lost my train of thought.
Great. Well, I'll go back to... I'll take over. No harm jumping in. I actually was thinking there that 4 seconds ago, that it's actually, why we do this, or why I do it, I know why you guys do it as well, is because we believe in it. That mm-hmm. we're not just, you know, doing a radio show or doing, you know, doing a podcast that's, or presenting media that's, it's what we do. This is actually because we feel and we're hope that it's contributing to making a better world. And I do see, I have to be honest, why I give the time is because I do feel it's a form of activism. It is a form of trying to change education. It's an information. You know, Paulo Freire talked about, you know, the pedagogy of the oppressed, that education through liberation is possible through education. And we need education. We need to be more informed about these things. We need to hear the different ideas and involve people in educating outwards. And in that way, you know, the time is frustrating, how much time it takes to organize, but it's obviously, it is because we believe in this.
Well, I think too that I suppose the best compliment when, is those with a completely different ideology saying that it's a must listen. You know, when people are on the opposite side of the fence.
Who would you tie to a chair and force them to say that?
No, actually, that was said.
No, we've had several people who have talked to us around that, and that is, there's no harm in that. Actually, it's funny because one of the, I did put it out to, we told patrons that we were going to do this get together, and we said to them, any questions that you want to ask us, and one of them was actually as blunt as this: isn't it all hopeless? Question mark. And I just thought,
I hope not. I mean, I wouldn't be doing this if I thought it was hopeless. I mean, I think you get to a point where it change becomes inevitable, and it's just getting everybody to that tipping point. But I think we're not too far away from it.
Tony, did you say he was a patron?
Yeah.
Okay, I'll answer his question. So, is it hopeless? It's a really good question, because I think that, you know, I've been involved in progressive politics and change for over 20 years. And I look at the world and, you know, the idealism I had in my very early 20s about, you know, been involved in protesting over global justice and trying to, you know, belief in social justice. And you look at the world and you go, is it worse now? Is it more unequal now? It is. But then you see other changes and you look at Ireland and I go, wow, Ireland has changed many ways for the better. And even globally, you look, I think that in ways, our politics and our governments have become more divorced and distant from what people think. Like even the, you know, you look at the Me Too movement, you look at climate change, and I just saw a tweet from Greta Thunberg saying that the oil companies have said, what's the greatest threat to the oil industry is actually the school climate strikes in terms of change. And you look at that, 20 years is a small period of time, actually. And then when you look at over the big, long period, you go, we have become, I think, a more active social, the people talk social movement society. People are much more engaged. Social media has empowered a lot of people to be engaged in a way they were never engaged. And I think we're in a bit of what Gramsci talked about, you know, the dying of the old, but the new has not yet been born.
Yes.
And I think we're a bit in that period of time. So while it seems, and it's not just seems, there is huge suffering going on, I see a lot of seeds of hope all over the place.
Yeah, I'd have to agree with you. I mean, honestly, there's no way I'd sit here day in, day out doing podcasts if I thought there was no possibility of change. I mean, of course there's possibility of change. If you look at Ireland, specifically at Ireland, the way voting patterns have changed over the last 20, 30 years, we're now at a situation where there is a minority Fine Gael government in power that, you know, that wouldn't have been thought of 20 years ago.
Yeah.
So things are changing. I mean, I had a guy on Twitter yesterday, and we are very much social media based. That is both our blessing and our curse. It is, to go beyond social media is very difficult. So it's a blessing and a curse. But a guy on yesterday, and he's going, oh, we've been here forever. We'll be here forever. Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael, one of us will always be in power. And I said, well, look, here's the facts. You've lost your vote. You're now less people vote for you than vote against you. So, you know, it's inevitable that you will sooner or later be in the back seat. No, never going to happen. Never going to happen. Oh, okay, fine. You're quite entitled to that opinion. But it is changing. And it only takes one election to change it all.
Yeah, I don't know what I agree that it takes one election. I think that there's a cultural change. Like I was just thinking, I think of Sláintecare, for example. The idea of a universal public health system that we could have, there's been no comprehensive plan made of that until now. in part, that is because, and we had Roisin Shortall in talking about it, and Sarah, who did fantastic work in supporting the committee and, you know, advocating this, that part of the reason why that developed was because of the weakness of the centre, the dominant parties, that they had to, all the committees aren't controlled by the dominant parties. And the Oireachtas committees have actually done really amazing work. We saw it in the Repeal the Eighth as well. But the Sláinte Care is there now as an ambition, as an aim. We have to try and, you know, continue to popularise it, make it happen. Similarly, the right to housing. The right to housing, you know, wasn't spoken about. It has taken a massive, you know, horrendous crisis to get it on the agenda. And the idea of cost rental homes, that we would somehow start building public, you know, and not-for-profit cooperative homes for anybody on any income. These are now becoming ideas that are becoming more mainstream. And the potential is there, I think, to really change things.
Myself and Tony were just discussing this earlier on this week. When we started out, I think people saw us as quite far to the left. Now they see us just as more general left, but we haven't changed position. We are where we started.
But that's not us. That's you see the Democratic position in the debates and who's going to be their nominee and things that Bernie Sanders was tutted for or wasn't even allowed to say out loud the last time he put himself forward are now actually at the adopted positions of the party. Mm. So what you've seen is that these conversations and the ideas, and part of the idea around Reboot and indeed some of the stuff we do with Echo Chamber, is that you have those conversations, you talk about evidence-based things that have worked in other areas, how can we adopt those models, be it whether it was the Lisbon decriminalisation model of drugs or something like cost rental with Mick Byrne. When you can get, like, let's face it, one of the secrets I've always had was always be the dumbest guy in the room and just sit there and try and take it all in. And when I'm learning, I find listeners are learning. So when I see a question like, isn't it all hopeless? I get that. I really do get that. But then when I turn around on the flip side, I go and I'm after having a conversation with Sean Healy from Social Justice Ireland, for example, and he's just left, and I'm all of a sudden realising that I feel like, yeah, this is great. We have something here to throw. You know that those things, those little things, those suggestions that go in these submissions, or you have these conversations, and you just get a seed in someone's head, and all of a sudden that idea then, you know, it opens other doors. And some of the policy changes that we've seen even over the last year have actually been stuff that the narrative, where people have come back to us and said, oh, I heard about that from you guys. You guys covered that ages ago. You guys were the first or even experts that we talked to, and they go, why aren't they on Tonight TV3? Why aren't they on?
No, I agree. And I think that idea of giving voices to people who don't have, you know, huge access to the mainstream media is really important. And they're, like, a lot of them are, you know, very people who are engaged at a very high level in terms of policy and practice. Like, that is really important. And there is a lot of stuff going on, a lot of ideas. And I think, though, the other two things, one is the climate change. I absolutely think that the climate movement represents one of the biggest potentials for real systemic change than we have seen probably for decades and decades and decades. Because there's a huge contradiction there. In terms of the way our economy currently operates and how unsustainable it is. And if we're actually going to become sustainable, it requires a radical change. But the importance of putting social justice at the heart of that change. And I think there's real hope there coming from that. And the other thing is, I think, how we have approached this podcast. Now, I've approached it, and Tony, and, you know, in terms of the Echo Chamber as well, is not coming from this fixed ideological standpoint or this fixed position. We are the left and you are left. And, you know, we only get lefties on here and we only get lefties who we think are left on here. You know, we are open and we are about trying to get, as you talked about, you know, where are things working in practice? Let's discuss those ideas. You know, and I think that the left could learn from that as well. I know a lot of people on the left are listening to us and going, yeah, that's interesting. And you show, okay, when we take down the dogma a bit, when we open up to lots of people who don't see themselves as left, there's a huge potential out there for the change we all want to see.
Yeah, no, I have to agree with you there. Not everybody who thinks they're centrist is actually centrist. Most of them are quite left and can be quite left. And the language is kind of divisive. It always is divisive. Progressive is a better way of looking at it. You've the progressives and the non-progressives. And there's quite a lot of people happy to sit there and say, no, we like the housing situation the way it is. No, I don't care about climate change. There's a lot of people out there to win over. It was something you're never going to win over. And I think that's a lesson we all have to learn. You can't win everybody over. You just can't. Any more questions, Tony?
Yeah, there's one I put to you, Martin, first, actually, because I just think this will be the most nonsensical answer. We'll get it out of the way. If you'd one day in charge, what would you do, Martin?
If I'd one day in charge,
very basic question, but I think I like it. You know,
yeah, it's a good question. Oh God, that's difficult. Okay, if I'd one day in charge, what would I do? I'd wipe all that.
If I had one day in charge, I'd extend my day in charge to about 20 years. Okay, seriously.
I do debt forgiveness. Yeah, debt forgiveness. That's what I do.
You're not a bastard. That's exactly, well, not exactly, but that was where my idea would have been to go into the European Investment Bank and tackle the debt.
Well, so you came at me looking for the nonsense. And it was yours.
You stole my one. Yeah.
I would set up a public housing company with the aim and finance of building 20,000 affordable cost rental homes each year for the next 50 years.
You'd go straight after housing, would you?
Yeah.
I would start with the debt. I would start with the debt. And I would go after, if I could, that would be the...
The problem is if you go after the debt, you write off the debt, then you're back into square one in 10, 15, 20
yeah,
years.
Yeah, but we're all obsessed by the fiscal rules. They're the ones that have to go first.
But debt forgiveness was part of the old world. It's how the old world operated. Every time there was a new pharaoh, there was debt forgiveness. So it's not that it stays, you know, people build up debts over time. It's just the way the world works. So debt forgiveness every 10, 15 years is a really great idea. It replenishes.
I just think the national debt is walking around at 206, 207 billion.
It's nonsense, really.
Yeah. If the next time something does kick us, and it will, you know, we don't have, they're talking about a rainy day fund of up to 2 billion, and you're going, 2 billion? That wouldn't get you broadband for two months.
There is a economics, though, you know, in part Keynesian economics, that doesn't view debt in the same sort of narrative. And you have to distinguish between your public, your state debt, and your individual debt.
Yes,
and
individual debt is what I'm talking about.
Okay, individual debt is different. I thought you were talking about...
Oh, I'm talking about...
I'm going for the
European Investment Bank.
The state public debt. The issue with the public state debt idea is that actually states can exist with massive debt and function quite well. And debt is really important in terms of being able to borrow, to invest for states, for countries, because collectively you pool your resources. And if you have sources of finance that aren't extortionate and that are like, currently the 0.1% what percent do we pay if we borrow at the moment,
yeah,
Tony?
Yeah, well, some people are paying to have, they're getting negative interest rates.
Yeah, because it's very much part of the neoliberal argument that, you know, we need to reduce the debt and, you know, fiscally responsible, the right wing, you know, and part of the right sort of ascendancy over the last 30 years has been this idea that the left screwed us when they were in power in the 60s and 70s because they created these heavily indebted states that paid for welfare states and all that. Whereas, in actual fact, debt, as I said, serves for countries you can borrow to invest. So it's important to distinguish, whereas what has happened over the last 40 years is we have privatized debt.
Yes.
We have individualized it. So it is the individual. In the past, in the 50s, 60s, people didn't have to take out as much debt to buy a home. And lots of people got public housing where they didn't have to take out debt to that level at all.
And if they did get... a loan for the house, they could get it from, there was state finance, there was grant aid,
exactly.
There was all of these things, yeah. Like, and then all of a sudden we financialized housing across the globe, actually.
But, and you're right though, in terms of debt, we financialized the entire kind of, we financialized so much of our lives and our economy and handed it over to private speculative financial institutions, and that's the whole issue of the AIB and all that.
I have a question, which is, you don't need to actually give me the names, but if you want to, have you interviewed anyone who you misjudged, Martin?
I purposely tend not to, and Tony will tell you this because it drives him mad, I tend not to read too much about the people that are coming in. I want to deal with the person from what I see, not from a preconception. So whilst I will look and see what they do, I don't want to delve too much into it until they get here. So then I can have like a real fresh opinion based on the way we talk here. So, with that in mind, nobody disappointed me in here. Everybody we've had has done a good interview. Have they subsequently disappointed me? Yes, of course. Of course. Tony, top of the fucking list. Yeah, absolutely. It happens. Of course it happens. You know, we talk to hundreds of people. It's hardly surprising that some of them won't be what you thought they were.
But nonetheless, like, you're still going out most weekends on your motorbikes with Carl Dieter, and you don't want listeners to know that.
Yeah, I wish, I wish.
Rory?
Yeah, I think it's a really interesting question, and I think that there are people who I would have had some preconceived notions in my head about, and anyone knows me very well knows I can have a fair few of those preconceived notions, and on the left, we have a lot of issues with preconceived notions about people and prejudices.
Yeah.
And I actually have to say that doing this podcast has been a really good way to meet lots of people who you mightn't talk to necessarily. And I think that's something we need to do. And it is, you know, I think of people like Seamus Coffey, for example, who, you know, was very open, gave some really interesting analysis. Even who we mentioned earlier, Jared Howland, I thought had some really interesting insights. Colm O'Gorman as well, I thought was very interesting. And not that I had preconceived notions about Colm, but I just thought there was a depth, you know, to his discussion and his linking of rights, which was really interesting. I think also it was more like people impressed me and even more than I'd expected. Someone like Kathleen Lynch as well.
Oh, yeah.
From UCD, who just, her way of describing things, her way of, you know,
the way she took down the people who get up early in the morning comment from the Taoiseach was amazing.
Yeah.
She related it to carers being up early to look after that relative, and she took that economic unit argument and said, people need people. And she brought it back that. And I remember thinking, yeah, that was a really impressive thing.
Similar. I'm going to flip that question on you, Tony. Come on.
I would say there was, okay. I could share that with a few people, but one that I suppose was I misjudged when I knew, the children's ombudsman, Dr. Niall Muldoon, was coming in. I was kind of going, okay, this is, someone in this office, you know, the office I was talking to, not the individual. So when this individual came in, then I was still talking to the office, and he turned out to be, unfortunately, from Donegal. But outside of that, he was really, really engaging, charismatic, I want to say, actually, as well, and talked about putting the, again, similar to Colm, Colm O'Gorman, bringing everything back to the rights-based society, putting children at the centre of things and building out from there, as opposed to these are our policies, these are our legislation. And I remember saying before he came in, I think I said to you, Martin, oh, we have coming in. I'll have to be sort of a bit more.
I told him to be on his best behaviour.
Yeah, yeah.
I said, okay. Tony, come on. I've organised for the children's ombudsman to come in. Don't F it up, all right? Don't start making your stupid jokes.
Don't meet him at the door with your top off. Yeah,
yeah. Interesting point you've brought up, Tony. Charisma. Because
the lack of it in this
room.
Yeah, definitely.
Okay, we've come across people who we know are very competent, very capable. But to get further than competent and capable, you need charisma. And you do. You need somebody in your organization with a little bit of charisma who's going to just take it. They don't have to be the brightest button in the pack, but they do have to be people person. Who have you come across?
Who? Oh, no, see, that's unfair.
That's a difficult one, isn't it?
It's unfair because there are people who across both pods, all the pods that we've done on the Tortoise Shack, that you go, you were so unexpected. Like, I mean, I always go back to and say, who blew me away?
Yeah.
It's probably a better question or better phrasing it. And I'd still say simply, Sinead Mercier.
Was just
stunningly intelligent woman who knew everything. We knew sitting down, I knew sitting downstairs when you're talking to people, having a cup of coffee before you come on, you're going, okay, and you're trying not to be a fan, but I know this is going to get me in trouble, but Mary Lou McDonald totally threw me off kilter by turning, what was it she said? She goes, you make a lovely cup of tea.
And Tony just had to pick him up off the floor.
Yeah, you make a lovely cup of tea, Tony. And I think Rory came to me for a question. I'm going, yeah, I do make a lovely cup of tea, don't I? You know, but there are things like that where you're sitting sitting there, and like, let's face it, this isn't a radio show. We're total amateurs, so we're doing this.
But there are superstars. There are superstars that have come. There are people who are going to be, who are big, but are just going to be bloody huge, and you can see them a mile off.
I know you just wanted to say it's you, Martin.
No. Simon would be one. Simon would be one. I mean, Simon is unique. He is uniquely intelligent, uniquely clever, and uniquely able to convey what he wants to say. He's very, very good.
I think it is clear about that. And I think charisma is really important, because what you're trying to do is, I think you're trying to connect with people in a way that just goes beyond giving across information. You're trying to do a bit of entertainment. You're trying to do a bit of connection. You're trying to do a bit of relating to people to inspire them. You're trying to inspire them.
Yes.
And I think that is what brings you to another level. And I do think someone like Colm, do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
O'Gorman from Amnesty is a very inspirational person. He brings something when he talks about it. Do you know what I mean? The sincerity, the depth to it. And I think charisma as well doesn't just come from a personality. It comes from a depth of experience, a depth of, you know, of life. And that's what has struck me. Peter McVerry is another one.
Yes, you know, yes.
That talks from a depth of experience, a depth of commitment. And within that is a charisma. And I think charisma is important, and I would agree with you. And it's important not to overemphasize it either, because there is a, you know, that you become caught up in the personality cult as opposed to actually substance. But I was thinking about it when you were saying that, you know, we're human beings, we're social animals. Do you know what I mean?
Yes.
You know, most of us, you know, who are fortunate to feel like we want to be part of a group, and, you know, we like to relate. We have, you know, and I was struck by that. In the podcast, we're having conversations. That has been the biggest thing that has struck me about doing the podcast is, I thought I was starting it with Tony was I was going to go interview people and I was going to, you know, see what information you could get out. And then you realize, and when people come in, they sit down, they get up afterwards, go, wow, there was something in that. There was a conversation that you have and a depth to the conversation, a time that the conversation has that normal media just can't get to. And I think that really struck me, that depth and charisma. You meet people like that and the charisma comes through, the inspiration comes through. But I think of someone like Catherine Conley, you know, who is a very understated person, but wow, is she powerful.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? The TD who can, and again, her depth of experience, her commitment to values, they're the people who have really blown me away, that despite all the crap, you know, they haven't fallen down the road of, you know, we're just defending our political party, we're just defending our ideology. Mm. They're there because they really genuinely care about other individuals and about society we have.
Rita Fagan,
absolutely another person. And you go, people like that, and you go, they're the people who should be promoted to the top.
Yeah.
Not the effing sociopaths who our society promotes to the top in politics and the top in private business and across the state. We know the people who get promoted to the top are the sociopaths.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
That is a fundamental problem. Because if you care about people, really genuinely care about them, you don't shit on people. But don't stab people in the back. But the people that are promoted to the top are the ones, and we have one in Taoiseach at the moment who has been very clearly, everyone says, would stab anyone in the back, but not just him, all the political parties.
People keep saying the mask slips with him. You're going, the mask, it doesn't wear a mask.
In a way, I don't want to personalise it.
I understand
it's
that.
It's not him.
But that's,
it's the cultures, and we look at all the politics. And you go, how do we create a politics and a society that promotes the people like Catherine Conley?
But do you not think that's reflective of our society? I think it is. I think there are, you know, 30% of people out there who really couldn't give a shit if you were on fire right this moment. They'd walk past you.
But the majority of people do care. And we supposedly live in a democracy where the majority of people's views count.
They do. Well, 30% will walk past you and not care. 30% will put you out. And the other 30% will sit in the middle and go, well, we agree the fire has a right to burn. we're a little bit worried about Rory, but we're centrists. So we can't do anything. That's the 30%. That's the 30% you have to work on. They are the 30%. You're never going to change the ones that don't.
The fire raises a few good points, Martin. I'm reminded with Rory's rant, actually, of Emmett Kirwan's the line where he says, you can get on the pod about, you can get away with anything in Ireland if you say it with a good accent, you wear a suit and you look presentable and you put forward and you don't swear, you know, it's like and you lose the argument if you're the guy who said fuck.
Yeah.
And as if that's the end of it. Like, oh, you know, well, okay, I'm putting forward a policy to take food from children, but you said fuck. You know, and...
there is, you know, we kind of have a fake faux morality that you'll see quite... Like, I mean, it came up recently. Somebody got recently milkshaked. I'm not even going to go into names or anything. But the fake faux morality then that surrounds that, or the fake faux morality with a politician, as you said, if there's bad language to use, you know... We all know, and everybody uses bad language. Show me someone in this country who doesn't use it. In fact, we are uniquely capable of using it. Real conversations will have the odd bad word, particularly when people are passionate about a subject. So I think, you know, we've got to ditch the fake and just concentrate on what's real. And a lot of people will follow then.
I'm going to jump away from the we've actually talked, there was a couple of other questions, but one of them you kind of answered at the outset and the other one we've all talked about. So I would like to say though, the last time we did this crossover, we talked about the results of the elections, how everything had, you know, the change utterly, and what we looked at. What we have seen in the last few days, we interviewed so many MEP candidates and we all talked about the need for the reform of the EU. Can you get out there and reform the EU? There's two things, and I'm going to play both sides of the fence here, and I shouldn't, but I am. Two things are really remarkable, right? There's a democratic deficit where the people who are put in charge were put in charge by people going off for 3 days and having this conversation and saying, can you agree on him? Well, no. Can we get a compromise? Can we get this? And the horse trading went on. And then the second thing that's super impressive is in 3 days, they managed to get all of these countries to agree to it. I mean, it's taken how long to do the Mercosur deal? 10 years? 20 years to do Mercosur.
Brexit even.
Brexit is my point. Yeah. So it's super impressive, but it's also super anti-democratic in its own way. And it just... So in one way you go, yeah, I can see why we want to be part of this EU, and I'm absolutely not advocating for Ireland to leave the EU. I'm just saying I'm also kind of Eurosceptic when I see that we come back and say, well, what's the compromise candidate who hasn't been elected, who is, you know, and we go, well, it's great news because... she has expressed opinions on Brexit, for example, which means, you know, our position on Brexit is okay. And we can't keep saying once they're okay with Brexit, everything is okay. Likewise, we can't keep saying the Mercosur deal is good because it's good for trade, but we can't, you know, food miles. And if we're really going to be serious about climate change, we actually can't afford to bring tons and tons of beef one way and send tons and tons of cars the other way.
Oh, well, I mean, the Mercosur deal has really favoured France and Germany. It really has favoured them. It's opening up markets to them. And yet it is, as Rory said, you know, green is, we're going to have to look at this hugely seriously. Everything is going to have to look at it from sort of a green perspective, and shipping beef into the EU when we already have too much beef. It's just nonsense, really and truly.
I think that. What struck me was, in looking at it, it was politics as usual.
Hmm.
And, you know, there wasn't a real change there. And so, I suppose, rather than feeling, again, hopeless looking at that, you look at, look, we're still in this process of achieving the change that needs to be achieved. And I think, I would similar to you, Tony, I think that's an interesting way of looking at it, that, you know, they did manage to agree it in 3 days, that we are part of these institutions. We don't like them in the way that they work, but we know they're important. There's some aspects of them, the way they work. And I think that particularly the green agenda, the social justice agenda, has to be really driven to the heart of Europe. And I think that's, you know, our challenge. And I think if you look at Ireland, I think that the elections had an impact most definitely in putting climate change to the top of the agenda. Housing, I think, was there as an important issue. I think that the left really, you know, has had to look at itself and reflect afterwards. And, you know, particularly Sinn Féin, have been talked about that very clearly. I think that the elections are have had an impact, are going to leave an impact. And again, the question of left unity we talked about. And there was an interesting idea put around, you know, at a minimum, we need to be talking about policy coordination. We've seen, for example, in Dublin City Council, we've seen the Social Democrats and the Greens and Labour, if I'm correct, coordinate with Fianna Fáil, you know, to develop what looks like a very progressive plan for Dublin. And the question of, you know, what type of politics brings change? How does the left engage in change? These questions are really, really, you know, are really important to talk about. But I think we can't talk about them in a way that's like, this is wrong, that's wrong. We have to talk about, you know, what are the issues that we want progressed? How do we see them changing policy-wise? And, you know, how are we promoting them and how are we working together to promote them?
Yeah, but then in the latest polls you see out, what you've seen is that Fianna Fáil are largely being forgiven and we're resuming back to the old pattern we were in.
But that negates what you've said earlier, that the two major parties are in decline. What we are seeing is actually, Fianna Fáil have... and Fine Gael have assumed a parity between their vote. Fianna Fáil have done a very good job of playing the chameleon again, which is what they've been politically very good at doing. But as Rory says, we can't be leftier than thou if they're going to enact progressive policies, whether it be on housing. You look at, you know, things like, I saw, like, and we can't just credit them for that, by the way, because we've seen things like with the glass bottle site where we're now going to take that into public ownership. It's going to be public housing for public land. Let's make sure this stuff is delivered.
It's not actually.
No, you get my point. It's the third time we've bought that land is my point, Rory.
Yes,
sorry.
But as far as I'm aware, that public glass bottle site, only a third of it is going to be public housing.
Yeah, but it was at 10% initially.
So 10% to 30% is a gain, yes, but it's not 100%.
And let's see that happen. Let's see these things happen.
Because, but I think what Martin was saying, though, to the polls actually showed that Fine Gael have fallen back.
Yes.
And that the independents have increased again. And that Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael are back to their 2016 election results,
yes,
which was a combined of in or around 52%. So
49.8% of first preferences.
That is a significant change in Irish politics that is not going away. And that, I think, is the question, is how does the broadest progressive left respond to that and go, how do we feel, you know, there is a potential for a progressive left government?
Of course, the numbers are there. The numbers exist for a progressive left government.
Yeah.
The only problem is that it's very hard to unify. And you say progressive left. Let's just say left, because we're not progressive till we unify. When we unify, we're progressive. We have to stop the infighting. We've all agreed on that. We've all agreed. And even from those of us who are very entrenched on, and I was, on a certain cycle of the left. And I'm like, you know, okay, Labour dirty the bit, but there's good people in Labour. There's a machine in there. There's some way we can encompass these people in. You know, you're going to have to get rid of the ones that were there beforehand, but the good people that are there, there's enough room to encompass them in. And there are good lefty people in Fianna Fáil. You've come across them. I've come across them. They can be encompassed into the broader left as well. But what you need is some vehicle to drive that, and we just don't have it. Water drove it. It drove a lot of unification.
Housing might drive it when it comes to a general election. I know it didn't feature as highly as we'd hoped, and that was a great disappointment to the three of us in this room, that housing didn't feature as highly in the Europeans and in the locals. But I think housing will feature more highly in the generals.
I think carbon tax is going to be the issue.
Yeah, I think the carbon is a potential. Absolutely, the carbon tax. But I think the conversations that have been had around that are emphasising the idea of a just transition. And the government and the ruling elite in Ireland have learned from the water. We will not see a debacle like that again, where they go, we're just going to hammer people and we don't care. They were terrified by that movement. And you will not see the carbon tax be rolled out like water. And I think that there is also amongst progressive the way we can shape a carbon tax to be a progressive social justice orientated, whereby, because I do believe people are not anti-tax, they're against tax injustice.
Yes.
And if they saw corporations and the highest and the wealthiest paying their, what they should be paying, the absolute majority of that tax, they would say, yeah, I will make changes in my life too. But I'm not going to sit here and be shat upon again and again and again while I see the top, you know, just heading off.
Sailing away.
Flying away once more in their private jet to destroy our planet, and I'm paying for it.
Well, it goes back. No taxation without representation. You know, that's what it all goes back to. If you're going to tax me, let me have a say about it.
Last thing, and I suppose, Rory, 1 year down, will you be here in a year's time?
I don't know, Tony. I hope I am. In the sense of, I hope I am physically still here on the planet if the kids haven't worn me down by then. But I think that what we have done, and what, you know, you put huge effort into, being the, you know, spending all, you know, so much time editing, uploading, putting it all together, you know, thank you for the huge work you do. It is really, you know, it wouldn't happen without you. Me and Martin would sit here, even though Martin's, you know, doing a little bit now, but in terms of but me and Martin would be sitting here talking to each other if it wasn't for you and what you have done, and fair play to you for that. I think that there is an issue, a real issue, around the question of the amount of time it takes, you know, because with family, with work, this, you know, requires huge organization in terms of getting guests in, you know, a huge amount of time commitment to do that, to get people, you know, to do the research before, to then give it the time that it needs and deserves. And so there's a real issue over its sustainability when you need, you know, other things, as you said, you know, bills have to be paid. So if you can earn some money from it, then it becomes viable as something, if you can get something from it. And so that is the question I know that we face. And, you know, while we're doing this because we love it and because we want to contribute, and that is a time that we give, I think there is a real issue for people who are listening, and the question we would put to them, you know, if you really value this, you know, surely you think there should be, number one, ensure that it's financially viable, to cover costs, and number two, the people that are doing it should be compensated, you know, for our time in that sense.
I have to say, with Reboot, I think that Reboot has changed some of the political scene that exists. It's certainly changed some of the narrative, or added to a narrative, and it's given people different options. But the biggest change I see is in you, Rory. That's the biggest change I see. I see that. And I'm going to be fairly blunt. You were pretty humorless when you first came in here. You were pretty damn humorless. And I think despite having a tough year, and you've had a tough year, and despite having a tough year, you're a more relaxed person than you were before you started Reboot. And that's a big change in you.
Yeah, and that is in part because it was a very difficult time that I was going through at that point in time. And so I think that... Yeah, I think that was a big factor. I'm not always as dry and humorless and downright
pedantic
as it was.
Yeah.
You know, I had our child Aaron born in March, and that was a massive relief and joy. And, you know, I think that it is. I probably relax more into it. I can't listen back to those first ones. Oh my God, they're so embarrassing. I've asked a number of times, will you just delete them, please? Please delete them.
Well, I get that. I would be very much of the mind that you're learning on the go. You're learning on the you're getting your reps in, as they say, as we're going, and it's an evolving situation. I think you've done great work. I think we've spoken to people who you wouldn't even have dreamt that we would get on into this little room in Glasnevin, and we have. And actually, if it stopped tomorrow, there's a body of work there that you should be proud of. So fair play to you. That's my pitch. And I do agree. It would be nice to see that, you know, Martin coming in and out from Ashburn and all the rest of it for nothing, Martin.
Yeah, I know.
For nothing.
I know.
I'd like to see, you know, that wasn't some.
But I do love you all. And that is the other end of this. I do actually love you all. I want you all to be happy and have houses and nice jobs. And, you know, I do want that to happen.
It feels really conflictual as well when you're engaged in progressive, you know, trying to help change things and contribute progressive ideas and be social justice orientated, while at the same time appealing for, you know, money. And then, you know, NGOs and charities do it all the time. We're appealing for a donation so we can run our organization. It's a legitimate appeal. It feels horrible to have to do it, but I think it's a legitimate appeal.
Well, you see, me and you have sort of some sensitivity to us. Asking other people for money is difficult, you know, and it is. And I'll say that it is. But this guy over here, no. He walks into the room. Give me fucking money.
Show me the money. I wish it was more.
Well, look. As I said, 1 year done. I think we should be able to. It's nice to reflect back and actually see that there's been so much great work done. And I do think it's helped give people something that they can go back to and say. When the idea for when I was thinking about it was when you get some idiots who goes on something and says, "Oh, so you can't do that." I wanted people to be able to say, "Well, I heard on Reboot Republic that you can."
Yeah. Well done, Rory.
I think that's a great success of Reboot Republic. Do head over to patreon.com/tortoiseshack. I know we've basically, Martin's making fun of me saying that I do always ask, but we do need it. Price of a cup of coffee. As I said before, Martin has holes in his jeans. Please get us a few bob. Talk to y'all soon. Take care. Bye bye.